is Originally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. An important set of documents have come out just barely in time. We're talking about documents that have been involving the Indiana Department of Environmental Management as far as the quality of water quality, we should say, for some wells that are located in the vicinity of several power plants that are powered by coal here in Indiana. Two of those four power plants in particular are here in Northwest Indiana. And the new data that's been released now for the first time is a requirement of a 2015 federal coal ash rule that is known as the CCR rule, has noted some dangerous levels of pollution at 14 sites around the state where the coal ash has been deposited. We'll find out more about coal ash and the impact, but it's interesting to note that on March 1st, which was just a day before these utility groundwater reports were released, the Trump administration, through the administration of EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt, have been trying to see a rollback take place of this federal coal ash rule that has been involved here. Let's find out more about it. Let's talk with Dr. Indira Frank. She is the Environmental Health Director for the Hoosier Environmental Council. Dr. Frank, thanks for joining us here on Originally Speaking today.
Glad to be with you.
Well, first, if you will, tell us about what coal ash is for folks who are not familiar with that and why there's such potential hazards in water quality because of it.
Sure. Coal ash is what's left behind after coal is burned. Coal has traces of heavy metals in it, but after you burn off the carbon, the ash that's left behind has higher concentrations of those heavy metals. So anytime coal ash comes in contact with water, you have the potential to contaminate water.
Is it that we find that the coal ash has all of these contaminants in it, I guess because the coal itself is inherently potentially dangerous in a way?
Well, I suppose coal left underground and far away from our water sources, not so much.
Right.
But once it's burned, it's in a fine particulate form, and the heavy metals are more concentrated. Yeah, unfortunately, relying on coal for our electricity has left behind millions of tons of this material. And because our power plants need cooling water, they're located next to bodies of water like Lake Michigan or our major rivers. So most of the coal ash has been left in sort of large landfills or open pits right next to those bodies of water.
Mm-hmm. If you will tell us about the work that was done, you and your colleagues there looking into the groundwater testing data, what did you rely on to get your data, and how did you come up with the findings?
Certainly. So utilities themselves are required under the federal rule to test the groundwater at their coal ash sites. That data was required to be made public March 2nd of mm-hmm. this year, so just a week and a half ago. And since then, we've been combing through those reports to look and see what impact there's been to groundwater. Now, in the past, there have been bits and pieces of groundwater data from coal ash sites, both here in Indiana and in some other states. And from that prior data, we were led to believe that anytime coal ash is left in an unlined pit or landfill, the groundwater underneath gets contaminated. The data that's just been released confirms that when the coal ash is left without a liner under it, and it comes in contact with water, you wind up with contaminated groundwater underneath.
We know that two of the four power plants that was mentioned here in the report are here in Northwest Indiana. Both of them are owned and operated by NIPSCO and are both still in operation, very much so every day. One of them is the Bailey Generating Station, which is right along Lake Michigan, and then the other is the Schaefer Station located in Jasper County. How are the setups for the coal ash disposal set up at those facilities as far as you know?
Okay. Just one moment. Mm-hmm. At the Schaefer Station, there are six impoundments. Only one of those has a liner under it. At Bailey, there are six of these sort of coal ash impoundments. But it's my understanding that those do have liners. Mm-hmm. And actually, this is a case in point. The data that we're seeing from the groundwater at Bailey has much less in the way of coal ash contaminants than what we're seeing at Schahfer and at some of the other locations around the state.
Does it seem that since we have in these cases here more liners and in the underneath the containment areas for the coal ash that and they may be newer ones, obviously they must have come under an earlier decision to be sure the liners are there, and as the case not the case I guess in Schahfer that the plant down there, because there are several of them down there and you mentioned some, most of them do not have liners.
Yeah, I can't comment on. I'm not familiar with what decision was made as far as liners being put under or not. Mm-hmm. Around Indiana, though, we have more than 80 coal ash ponds, and the majority of them do not have liners underneath.
Do we find that in areas apparently like here in northwest Indiana where the power plants are so prevalent in close proximity to wells, certainly, and to residences, that maybe some locations have been able to be a little proactive, like in the case of maybe in northern Indiana here at maybe near the in particular, I suppose, the Bailey plant, because it's right along Lake Michigan, to be sure that there's better provisions for dealing with the possible contamination of water supplies?
I mean, the best thing that can happen with coal ash mm-hmm. is to put it into a landfill that has an impermeable liner underneath it and an impermeable cover over the top of it so that water can't come into contact with that ash, and then for that ash landfill to be further away from our waterways. You don't want to have a facility like that right next to a river, because over time, rivers change their course and could erode into the coal ash. In other states, we're seeing additional precautions taken to protect water resources from coal ash. Mm-hmm. In North Carolina, South Carolina, and Alabama, most of their coal ash sites are being taken, or the coal ash is being taken away from their major waterways and put into lined landfills. Now, so far in Indiana, we don't have plans in place to get our coal ash moved to lined landfills on high ground. In mm-hmm. fact, a lot of our ash facilities right now are present in floodplains of our major rivers. but Indiana is in the process of revising its rules for coal ash. The Hoosier Environmental Council, my organization, is advocating that Indiana have, as it rewrites those rules. Excuse me.
I'll let you take a sip of water here. We're talking with Dr. Indira Frank. She is the Environmental Health Director for the Hoosier Environmental Council. And she and her staff have been working here, looking through the data, the first opportunity that's come about to look at data coming from power plants that were powered by coal here in Indiana, and check out the impact that the coal ash pits, that's, of course, where the coal that comes out of the boilers ends up, and in storage, at least for the time being, and then some the pits, and what kind of impact that could possibly have on the water supplies and particular wells that are in the ground nearby. Dr. Frank, since you've had a chance to go through all of this data and this opportunity, and you only had, I guess, a matter of days after they came out, I guess, to really get going here. I know that the Indiana Department of Environmental Management is undergoing a coal ash ruling process, and what kind of impact, as best as you can tell, that the rules from IDEM might have, especially in light of the fact that the U.S. EPA is trying to make sure that the rules never take light of day again?
Well, yeah, so the EPA, unfortunately, has put forward a proposal to roll back the coal ash mm-hmm. regulations. here in Indiana, we have an opportunity to do something similar to what's happening in the Carolinas. As our rule is being written, we hope that it'll be written to take the coal ash out of the floodplains, further away from our waterways, right, and put impermeable liners under it.
as best as you can tell there by looking at the data, and your colleagues at the Hoosier Environmental Council have been able to work, are there these sites that might be available that the power plants can be able to use? And we know in some cases, I know that, in fact, NIPSCO is making plans to close up some of the plants. I understand Bailey Generating Station along Lake Michigan near the Port of Indiana is one of those that is at least scheduled to be closed here sometime in the next few years. And Schahfer as well is undergoing, I guess, plans for some big changes too. Do you think that some of these changes could take place and in turn be able to follow through on the proper places to dispose of the coal ash?
Well, yeah, there is more and more movement toward or away from using coal for electricity, and that's beneficial. Mm-hmm. We just have to make sure that the legacy ash that's left behind from all the decades of using coal is handled properly. Also, we're hoping that there can be testing of any private wells that are near the current coal ash sites. We've had some people on private wells affected by coal ash in the past, and there are already three sites in Indiana where people on private wells have been put on alternate drinking water sources by the local utility.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know in NIPSCO's case in particular, we know that they've had to do some extensive work in the town of Pines.
Because
it's their wells have been affected by the potential contamination of coal ash.
Right, yeah, there were more than 260 homes and businesses that had to be put on a different water source.
Mm-hmm. How do things, in your estimation, from you, what you and your colleagues have gone through in the data that you've had a chance to look at here concerning the coal ash and the problems that can cause for water quality in Indiana, what seems to be, I guess, besides the changes in how the coal ash is disposed of, and for that matter, just taking off the possibility of using coal for generating power, what might be some ways to help in turn to reduce the possibility of some more water contamination?
Really, the most important things that we'd like to see happen are testing private wells near current coal ash, mm-hmm. and then taking the coal ash away from our waterways and into dry, lined landfills on high ground.
So it's just doing the best you can, I guess, to get the contamination as far away from the water sources as possible, I understand.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah, it's to make sure that coal ash doesn't come into contact with water.
Well, now that you and your colleagues have worked on this current data, is there any more or any other information that you're working on or hoping to be able to work on here dealing with the coal ash problem from the power plants in Indiana?
Well, the groundwater monitoring that was required under the federal rule continues, mm-hmm. and so we will continue to monitor those reports as they come out. We are also monitoring plans for closure of some of these coal ash facilities, and looking at how they're planning to do the closure. And again, we're hoping that when a coal ash pit is closed, that the ash will wind up with a liner under it and away from the waterways. So we're monitoring the closure process as that's happening too.
Well, Dr. Frank, thank you very much for taking some time to explain what you and your colleagues there at the Hoosier Environmental Council have been doing in the study and the review of this groundwater testing data. It's fortunate that you had the data, and I guess all we can hope for is that the federal government doesn't keep IDEM, certainly, and organizations like the Hoosier Environmental Council from having access to the data in the future so that you can continue to monitor the impact that these coal-fired power plants have on water supplies. We know that Indiana is dealing with problems all across the state, and it's not just local, in making sure there's enough fresh drinking water for everybody, and these are ways to try and preserve that supply.
Yes, it certainly is.
And thank you very much for being with us to talk about this today. We do appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Dr. Indira Frank is her title is the Environmental Health Director. She works for the Hoosier Environmental Council, and she and her colleagues there at the HEC have been reviewing the groundwater testing data that has come in under the requirement of the 2015 federal coal ash rules. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. It's almost that time. Time for a week of great jazz at Valparaiso University, performed by high schoolers and professionals. And I had a chance to talk at length recently with Professor Jeff Brown, who is the creator of the university's annual jazz festival. Jeff, if you will, give us an idea of the rundown for the, I guess will be the 33rd annual. Oh, 33rd annual jazz festival at Valparaiso University.
I started when I was 8 years old.
It seems like it. I'm sure. I know.
No, we're very excited about this year. This is our 33rd year, and it involves some of the things that we've kind of become known for, and a few brand new twists. The Monday on April 2nd, we have some local high school jazz ensembles, some of them who have performed there in the past, a nice representation of various counties. We have Chesterton and Portage from Porter County. We have Hobart from Lake County. Of course, Valparaiso will be there. And a brand new ensemble to the festival this year, Kankakee Valley, will be there. And it's an interesting part of the festival because these ensembles are used to doing festivals, but they're very competitive festivals, and they're adjudicated, and you win awards and all those things. And I don't have a problem with those. There's a place for those. But when I started doing this back many years back, I thought that there would be a place for a festival that the students could come and perform in a professional environment without the rigors of being adjudicated. So that's what it is. They come and they perform in a professional environment. Each of them prepare about a 22-minute set. And we pretty much stay on time.
They probably enjoy this more so than the judged events because they get to perform, they get to play, and they get to have fun. It's a way to show off your skills, and certainly to them it is because they're budding musicians, to be sure. But they're really learning how to be really true jazz musicians this way, aren't they?
True, and a lot of the directors like it just as much as well. The students over the years, interestingly, I've had many of them come to study at VU with me. That my first encounters with them have been them appearing at the festival in high school, and they say to me that performing at VU's festival was they personally did some of their best playing because they didn't feel the pressure that a lot of the other adjudicated festivals like other universities and other places.
Now, of course, after we get the students coming in and showing their stuff, first of the week here, by the time we get to Wednesday and Thursday in particular, we get to hear more from your groups here at Valparaiso University. Tell us what the jazz ensemble has in store when they have their concerts on Thursday evening.
Well, Don Braden is an excellent jazz tenor saxophonist, arranger, composer, clinician. His style of playing is a very blues, soulful, stylistic way, but with a very advanced harmonic tinge to it. His compositions are very challenging. The jazz ensemble will be performing five of his original compositions and arrangements. We also commissioned a work which is called Eddie-ish, which is a composition in the style of Eddie Harris, which was a friend of Don Braden's. Kind of those of you who are listening out there, kind of in the 1960s Les McCann, Eddie Harris type of sound. And so we'll be premiering those. And the jazz ensemble this year has some very strong student improvisers. And so it's a very great experience for them to be able to be exposed to someone of his talents.
Now we come up to Friday here of the concert, which of course would be Friday, April 6th, and we have the headline acts, so to speak, coming in, the professionals coming into town to do the performance for everybody who wants to attend. I know that the tickets always seem to disappear at the Hara Union for the weekend coming up here. And we have, I guess, first you have the opening act is the Bill Boris Trio. folks that maybe are not familiar with Bill Boris, tell us a little bit about him.
Well, Bill is a native of this area. He grew up in Munster and in Gary, and I've known him since we were both 10, and Bill is one of the finest jazz guitarists in the United States. He's a professor at Columbia in Chicago, and he has an organ trio that will be performing as the warm-up act for Tierney Sutton, and that's a Hammond B3 organ, guitar, and drums. It's a very unique, incredibly big sound. It's very nice, and he'll be doing some of his own compositions and some standards. Tierney Sutton is an amazing vocalist. She's one of these vocalists that is certainly strongly rooted in the jazz vein, but her repertoire is so broad. It's R&B, rock, everything. She's one of the vocalists out there that truly utilizes her voice as a unique instrument in an instrumental context with a trio behind her. It's not just singing lyrics. It's her scatting, acting and reacting with the various instruments in the ensemble. Her group was nominated for a Grammy in just ensemble arranging, which is quite amazing.
Do you get the impression that she basically obviously have learned very well the styles of not only Ella Fitzgerald when you talk about scat singing, but also even going back even as far as Billie Holiday, who was able to use her voice as an instrument, was considered as much if not more of a musician rather than a vocalist?
Especially Billie Holiday's text there, but you know, you talk about Ella Fitzgerald, and you talk about the establishment of quite an art form of being able to meander from a lyric to scatting. Mm-hmm. Some of those great recordings of, like the one recording that comes to mind is she's performing live "Mac the Knife," mm-hmm. and she forgets the lyrics, but she remembers all the modulations, and she scats through the entire tune, and it's for those out there listening, they know the exact recording I'm talking about. It's absolutely amazing, yeah. And so yes, Tierney is a vocalist that has a strong respect and knowledge of the past, but is certainly forging an incredible future.
We're talking with Jeff Brown about the 33rd Annual Jazz Festival coming up at Valparaiso University. And we've had enough festivals now, and certainly since the very beginning, Jeff, you've seen how it has evolved. And I guess how jazz has evolved as well, too. You take us back to the first ones. What were some of the great artists and other people that came on early in the evolution of the Jazz Fest, and how has the music itself changed over the years to bring us to this point now for this year to have the artists coming up here on this 33rd annual event?
Interestingly, from the VU Faculty Jazz Trio was the very first act 33 years ago, and what's kind of transformed a little bit over the past maybe 20-some years is that individual jazz artists aren't going out and performing with in-house rhythm sections as much as they used to. Mm-hmm. You find there being more organized groups going out. In the earlier years, the trio played with people like Slide Hampton, Art Farmer, incredible musicians. And then indeed what I would be able to do is parlay those performances in with them doing appearances with the University Jazz Ensemble. There's still the same types of ensembles out there. There are big bands, there's trios, there's quartets, there's chamber ensembles, literally of every size. I think that what you're seeing at festivals worldwide is presentations by smaller groups due to the nature of the whole international booking situation that is going on. And I think that, but if people really want to look for festivals that have big bands, those are out there as well. Also, festivals have gotten very specialized. There's traditional jazz festivals. There's festivals that highlight various compositional styles. There's a difference between university types of festivals and professional festivals and how they're approached. So there's something out there for everybody. I just think people need to look a little bit harder.
Well, Jeff Brown, thank you very much for talking about this festival coming up, the 33rd Annual Valparaiso University Jazz Festival.
Thank you.
The 33rd Annual Jazz Festival at Valparaiso University will be held on April 2nd through 6th on campus. And check out the website that is on the vu.edu website in particular about the 33rd Annual Jazz Festival. And be sure to get your tickets arranged right now if you intend to go. Once again, it's time for the Valparaiso University Annual Soup Bowls for the Hungry fundraiser. It's going to happen on the campus. And to talk about it, we have, of all people, a ceramics instructor. Michelle Carrazzo is one of the people who are key in beginning this program going and making it the success that it has been. And it's a good reason why ceramics are involved in helping feed the hungry. And Michelle, thank you for being with us on Regionally Speaking.
You're welcome.
Well, tell us the importance, first off, I guess it should be obvious, but maybe not, why it's important to use bowls or soup bowls in particular to feed the hungry.
It's more a metaphor. You know, the national program is called the Empty Bowl Project, and it was started, it's just a loose collection of potters who decided to use their skills to, you know, help usually nonprofits or any organization they want. The bowl becomes a metaphor for feeding the hungry. We're all very excited about it, and the whole art department participates now. So there's all sorts of art, you know, from photography to drawings, and the teachers contribute also.
Now, we know that this involves soup bowls, and we're talking here in this case actually creative and unique soup bowls, an art that's created by the Valpo students and staff that'll be up for bid for the project. But there's a proceeds that's definitely going to benefit locally for this. Tell us about the group that's going to be the most beneficiary of the project.
This year, the name of it is Project Neighbors.
And do you know much about this organization? What do they do here in Northwest Indiana and in the Valparaiso area in particular?
Very interesting. I was quite surprised when I read about them. They are kind of a vehicle to help all sorts of organizations from that need help.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be channeling eyeglasses somewhere or building projects or any food banks. Things like that.
I see. Now, this year's event happening on Friday is going to happen at the Art and Psychology Building on the Valparaiso University campus. Tell us, Michelle, a little bit more about the event and the fact that there's actually going to be not only soup bowls on display for the silent auction, but actually some soup involved.
I've been really fortunate. We go through at least probably 5-6 crock pots of all sorts of delicious foods, some of them vegan, some vegetarian, some meat or fish, just depends, and then cornbread. So people really enjoy that while they're kind of fighting with each other to get the highest bid. And you can also throw a pot in the mm-hmm. potting room. I have my students there to help guide you in making a little pot if you want.
for some people, it's probably been a long time since they've done that. If they've, if they're not a potter or they don't seem to have the skill, maybe the last time they did that was something maybe even in kindergarten or first grade. Might have done something with clay then, and then here's their chance to put their skills, although now as an adult, back to work, I imagine. And I also understand, too, that there's going to be an interesting raffle that's going to be offered as well, too, during the event on Friday.
That is new as of last year, and we weren't sure how it would work. It was a great success.
Mm-hmm.
One of the teachers, last year it was Sarah Jancy, she did a beautiful drawing of a couple who won the raffle. So we're repeating that, and I think it's a great thing to have.
Tell us more about Abby Bodine and how she's involved in offering up the raffle prize this year.
Well, at our faculty meeting, I asked around who would like to do it, and everyone kind of looked at Abby.
It's your turn this year to do it, I suppose. That's great.
Yes, and she very kindly said she would be happy to do it. She's the graphics design teacher, so I have no idea what will come of it, whether it will be a drawing or she'll go into the graphic arts and do some manipulation, and we'll just have to see. The chance to decide that.
Well, it'll certainly be a great way to close out the day. We're talking about the annual Soup Bowls for the Hungry fundraiser that's going to happen, put on by the Valparaiso University Art Department. It's going to happen Friday the 23rd, starting at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and it's going to be held in the Art Psychology Building on the Valparaiso University campus. And if you have more questions, you can go on to the Valparaiso University website and find out more, or just show up at the Art Psychology Building at 4 o'clock on Friday and enjoy some soup and see some very creative soup bowls, and maybe even make one yourself if you're so inclined. And Michelle Carrazzo, thank you very much for talking about this, and hope you have another great year with the annual Soup Bowls for the Hungry, and all of this going to help an organization that is going to help other people out in the community as well, too. Thank you for spending time with us today.
Thank you.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for supporting Lakeshore Public Radio. We'll be back with you tomorrow.